Cobb County, Georgia. They decided that they would put this sticker in the front of their textbooks, which says, "This textbook contains material on evolution. Evolution is a theory, not a fact, regarding the origin of living things. This material should be approached with an open mind, studied carefully, and critically considered." And most of you are aware of the fact that that particular sticker was ruled to be unconstitutional because of the religious content involved. Now, yes, I do wear glasses, but I wish somebody could show me exactly where in the text of that particular sticker there is quote-unquote religious content. Sir Arthur Keith made the comment. He said, "Evolution is unproved and unprovable. We believe it because the only alternative is special creation, and that is unthinkable." And unfortunately, that's how many of my colleagues approach the situation. It's not really an open-minded, let's evaluate what's really there approach. It's, we have to rule out the God possibility, and then we'll look at the alternatives. What is the truth? If we were to put both creation and evolution in a court of law and try to determine precisely which one is holding more truth, what would we learn? For instance, we talk about the age of the earth. I suspect everybody in here within the last month or so has heard some news account, maybe read in the paper, about millions and millions of years ago. That's the standard evolutionary dogma. If I were to ask you tonight, how old is the earth just using your Bible? If we didn't listen to anything else, no Time magazine, no CNN, if we just went to our Bible, what would we discern about the age of the earth? And let me up front admit the fact that we know there's not a passage that says the earth was created on this specific date, and there's not a specific passage that says the earth is this many years old. But there are some things that we can deduce. For instance, we know that from us to Jesus is roughly 2,000 years. We know that because we use the time that he walked this earth to date our calendar dating system. It kind of makes me happy that when an atheist fills out a scientific paper, submits it to be published, it has a date on it that signifies when Jesus Christ was on this earth. Let you think about that one for a while. What about the time between Jesus back to Abraham? Again, roughly 2,000 years. The way we can learn that is either we can go to the library, we can check out books that tell us when certain kings reigned, or we can turn to the Bible. What about Abraham back to Adam? Now, bearing in mind the fact that many of those records were washed out by the flood, can we deduce how long a period it's been between Abraham and Adam? I think so. You know, those passages that most of us really love, Genesis chapter 5 and 11, Luke chapter 3, those passages that start out so-and-so begat so-and-so, you know, the genealogies. My wife and I, we try to read the Bible through together in a year, and I got to tell you, it's very, very tempting when we get to some of these chapters just to start verse 1 and skip all the way down to the end. But friends, what I want you to do in the coming week is look at some of these chapters and see what you're really given. Because you'll notice you're not just given people's names, you're also given the age at which the father is when he has children and the age at which he is when he dies. That's not genealogy, that's chronology. And when you do the math, you're going to find out that that's also roughly 2,000 years. So if we just go by the Bible, nothing else, it's pretty easy to see that the age of the earth is less than roughly 10,000 years old. And somebody says, well, wait a second, Brad. There are 55 generations of people listed between Jesus and Abraham, and there's only 20 listed between Abraham and Adam. And yet you're going to stand up there and tell us that both of these time periods was 2,000 years? That's 35 generations of difference. Yeah. Because you remember how old people were living back during this time? Vast old ages. A lot fewer generations. But the Bible's not going to get very far in a science classroom, is it? Can you imagine the scene where little Johnny He's sitting there. His teacher talks about millions of years. He raises his hand. He says, Miss Sally, the Bible says the earth is only about 10,000 years old. And Miss Sally's going to pat him on the head, send him back to his seat, and ask him to please remain quiet. Are there scientific evidences that the earth is young? I think there's a lot more than most people are familiar with. If you haven't had an opportunity to pick up some of the article reprints in the back on the right, let me encourage you to do so, because those are actually able to go into a lot better detail than I can in just an hour or so presenting things to you. They talk about, for instance, the earth's young magnetic field, starlight and time, some of those types of things. But I want us to look very quickly at just a couple of the things that really do point to a young earth. For instance, we can look at Niagara Falls and how much it has worn back. We can talk about how much sediment the Mississippi River is dumping into the Gulf of Mexico. And ask the question, if the Mississippi River really was 4.6 billion years old, how much further should the delta stretch out? That's not really the question. The question is, would there be a Gulf of Mexico? And the answer is no, it should have filled in. Polystrate fossils. You know, evolutionists are well adapted at telling us which layers were laid down over which periods of time, how many millions of years. The only problem is, on all continents, we have fossils that transcend through two, three, four of those layers. For instance, fossilized trees. California has a baleen whale that has been fossilized, transcends through several of these layers. Question, how do you get a fossilized tree that goes through layers that are supposed to each layer be millions of years old? So, for instance, we look at the Niagara Falls. What I want you to notice here is this deep gorge that's been cut out. That gorge is cut as the water runs over the leading edge of the falls. It wears back the rock. Now, we know up until about the 1960s, it was wearing back at a rate of 4.7 feet a year. From this picture, you can see where the leading edge of the waterfall was at specific years. 1960s, we put in what are called water diversion units to slow that down. 4.7 feet a year. I want you to ask yourself the question, if this earth really were 4.6 billion years old, how far should that Niagara Gorge stretch? It should lap the globe twice. And yet, interestingly, this textbook says a simple calculation shows that it's been about 9,900 years since the Niagara River started cutting its gorge back. Friends, that's a whole lot closer to what the Bible says. Or we could look at population statistics. We know today precisely, within give or so 100,000 people or so, how many people are on the earth? Roughly 6.4 billion people. We've also been taking the census long enough to know that the population is doubling every 35 years. Now that includes famine, disease. So every 35 years the population doubles. That means 35 years from now roughly we'll have 12.8 billion people. And you think traffic's bad now. But friends, we can use that same information and we can extrapolate backwards to a time in which there was literally just a handful of people. And when you do the math, you're going to come up with a number of roughly 4,500 years ago. And you say, 4,500 years? I thought you just said the Bible says the earth is roughly 6,000 years old. Yeah? But what happened roughly 4,500 years ago that dropped us back down to just 8 people? You see, friends, the numbers literally don't lie. Now, man-made theory sometimes will, but the numbers don't. If we were to use evolutionist numbers, this planet could not hold all of the people that should be on it. Many of you have probably seen beautiful formations like the stalactites you see here on the screen. You know, evolutionists tell us that tiny drops of water over millions of years are what caused these. In fact, I imagine some of you have probably gone through Mammoth Cave or some of the caves around here, maybe been led down, and had park rangers tell you that those formations take millions of years to form. And yet, friends, that's the Lincoln Memorial. It was built in 1922. Hopefully I don't have to tell you that indoor plumbing has not been around for millions of years. I imagine some of you are old enough to really appreciate indoor plumbing. Over in England, there's a place called Mother Shipton's Cave over in Yorkshire. You can take a teddy bear, a hat, or one of your favorite trinkets. You can tie it to a string in that cave. You can come back 3 days later, and that trinket will be completely covered over, just like a stalactite or a stalagmite. It doesn't take millions and millions of years. For instance, this is a bat covered in a stalagmite. You just got to ask yourself the question, did that little bat stay on the top of that stalagmite while tiny drops of water hit him in the back over millions of years? Or have we been sold a bad bill of goods about the dating system? This is a newspaper clipping out of the Chattanooga Times Free Press, October the 2nd, 2003. And for those of you who can't really make out what that is, that's a fishing reel embedded in limestone rock. Now, ladies, I recognize some of you may not be fishermen, so let me explain to you. Fishing reels haven't been around that long. In fact, they've only been patented about the last 120 years or so. And yet, allegedly, that rock is 300 million years old. You got a little problem there. How do you get a 100-year-old fishing reel in a 300 million-year-old rock? We've actually seen it. We had our scientific illustrator go down and verify that this thing was real, that it was not a forgery. The gentleman who owns it, actually, on this picture you can see, you can physically lift the whole rock just by holding onto the reel. It's firmly embedded in there. The gentleman who found it, he found it in a riverbed. He took it to the University of Tennessee, Chattanooga's geology department. And the article talks a little bit about what their response was. They didn't have a clue of how this happened. He went from department person to geologist to geologist. And they all basically shrugged their shoulders and said, we don't know. But they were sure that that rock was 300 million years old. That was a specific kind of limestone. And then the department chairman walked in. I want you to look with me at what he had to say. Dr. Chernett stated, I'm the chairman of the department. I say this does not exist. It's a figment of our imagination. Well, friends, I hate to be the one to tell him, but it really does exist. And while he may have just been simply kind of tongue-in-cheeking it, so to speak, we need to realize what's happening in this country. When we get evidence in that actually rules out the evolutionary theory, we're not throwing out the theory, we're throwing out the evidence. And yet maybe it's time that we take another look at that theory. You see, the problem is, in this particular country, by the time your child is 5 years old, he or she has already been indoctrinated by the evolutionary theory. The reason I can say that is because of these creatures right here, the dinosaurs. There are not many young people who don't love dinosaurs. My four-year-old at home, when he was 2 years old, for the life of him, he could not say apple juice. It was apple juice. But he could rattle off a five-syllable dinosaur name like nobody's business. Hey, Dad, look at the Dimetrodon, the Brachiosaurus, the Patasaurus. Can I have some apple juice? Children love them. We're amazed by it. For instance, news report out of the Sahara Desert 2 years ago. The second largest dinosaur ever known to have existed. Called the Parlatitan. Estimated to weigh roughly 80 tons. Now, just to give you an idea how big that is, our largest imperial elephant weighs somewhere between 7 and 10 tons. This guy would have dwarfed our largest elephant. Ask yourself this question. Where are you going to find enough food to feed a creature that big in the Sahara Desert? Unless, as we talked about last hour, this earth once was that beautiful mantle of spring-like loveliness. The largest dinosaur that we've ever discovered is called the Argentinosaurus. And I bet you can't guess where they found him. Texas? No, I'm just kidding. They would like to think so. This guy is estimated to be roughly 110 tons. If you want to see them, you've got to go down to the Fernbank Museum in Atlanta, Georgia. But friends, it's because of these amazing creatures that we are losing so many of our young people. Because after all, how many folks do you know of who are ready and willing to harmonize the dinosaurs with the Bible? So what usually happens is our child picks up a book just like this one from the Magic School Bus. Very popular series for children. Little boy holding a magazine there says, "This story is make-believe." His friend says, "Yeah, there were no dinosaurs in the time of cave people." Top left-hand corner. "No people ever saw a dinosaur." It goes on to say, "When early humans appeared on the earth, dinosaurs had already been dead for millions of years." People found out about dinosaurs from fossils. And that's pretty much what our kids are learning. Went to a camp. I surveyed the Christian young people there. I gave them three questions. How old's the earth? Where did the universe come from? When did dinosaurs walk the earth? Over 50% of those young people who were raised in a Christian home indicated that dinosaurs walked the earth millions of years ago. Now, question. How do you harmonize that with Genesis chapter 1 that tells us all land-dwelling creatures were created on day 6? See the problem? National Geographic, GeoGuide page says, "No human being has ever seen a live dinosaur." The bottom of the page, it goes on to encourage parents, "Use this GeoGuide page to help capture the interest of young readers. Stimulate discussion with them." Discussion about what? Oh, the fact that no human being has ever seen a live dinosaur. Let's ask the question. Has a human being ever seen a live dinosaur? Because you see, the question before us tonight is not, did the dinosaurs exist? We know they did. We have found their fossilized remains on all 7 continents, Arctic to Antarctic and everywhere in between. The real question is, when did they exist? Was it millions and millions of years ago? Or could they possibly have coexisted with humans just a few short thousand years ago? I want to share with you some evidence that you're probably not going to see in your child's science books. Before I do that, I want to give you about a 3 or 4 minute lesson, history lesson on the dinosaurs. The most recent discovery, as far as recent times is concerned, happened in the year 1822. A gentleman by the name of Gideon Mantell, he was a country English doctor. He had to go visit a patient, and on this particular occasion, his wife Mary Ann decided to join him. They loaded up in a horse and buggy, made their way out to the patient's house. Dr. Mantell went inside. Well, Mary Ann decided that she would take a little stroll. And so as she's out there walking along, she comes across a large pile of stones that had been purposely set there on the side of the road. Except one of them didn't look like a stone. It looked like a tooth. Only it was much, much too large to be a tooth. She'd never seen anything like it. So she picked it up. She took it back to her husband, showed him. He was amazed. He'd never seen anything like it. And being in the scientific community, he decided he'd show all of his friends. They had never seen anything like it. They eventually went back to where those rocks had been, the quarry where those rocks had been cut from. They found more teeth and bones. And in 1825, Dr. Mantell named that long-dead creature Iguanodon, meaning literally iguana tooth. Because it looked like the tooth of an iguana, only it was much, much larger. It would be about 20 years later, 1845, when a gentleman named Sir Robert Owen would come along, and he actually coined the term dinosaur. He used 2 Greek words, dinosauros, translated by him as fearfully great lizard. And friends, that's when our fascination with these creatures began. The question before us tonight is not, did they exist, because we know they did. The question is, when did they exist? Hopefully most of you saw in January of last year a report that came out in one of the leading scientific journals about a dinosaur in the belly of a mammal. Now think about that for just a moment. Allegedly, mammals evolved from dinosaurs. And yet we have scientific proof of a dinosaur in the belly of a mammal. What does that do to the evolutionary theory? Or maybe somebody could explain to me the Ica stones from Peru. A fellow by the name of Dr. Javier Cabrera was given one of these stones as a present. He looked at it. He noticed there was a very unique carving on it. He went to the farmer who gave it to him. He said, "What is this?" The farmer said, "Oh, these are Incan burial stones. They were placed in the tombs of the ancient Incan Indians." Well, Dr. Cabrera set out to find as many of them as he could. All told, he found about 11,000 of them. And over a third of them show very detailed, specific designs of dinosaurs. But not just dinosaurs, friends. Dinosaurs and men. I actually brought one with me. We have 9 of them. They range in size anywhere from about the size of a basketball to, as you can see from what I'm holding, roughly the size of a large orange. One of our translators came to us from Lima, Peru. He was able to talk to the Cabrera family. The interesting thing about these stones is what's actually carved into them. For instance, the ancient Incan Indians drew sauropod dinosaurs with dermal frills on their back. These little, kind of look like frills of a sailfish, so to speak. And for the longest time, researchers looked at that and they said, "That's not accurate. We've never seen dermal frills on the back of a sauropod dinosaur." That was until 1992. When an article appeared that was titled "A New Look for Sauropod Dinosaurs," paleontologists said, "Recent discovery of fossilized sauropod skin impressions reveals a significantly different appearance for these dinosaurs. The fossilized skin demonstrates that a median row of spines was present. Some are quite narrow, others are quite broader and more conical." The ancient Incas got it right the first time. Ellen Morris Bishop wrote, "The biggest spines found were about 9 inches long, shaped a little bit like a shark's dorsal fin. The smallest at the tail tip were about 3 inches high." Another thing that they drew on some of the dinosaurs, and actually one of the ones we have in the office, you can see bumpy rosette patterns on the skin of the dinosaurs. And again, researchers said, "That's not accurate." That was until 1998, when in fact they discovered dinosaur embryos that had these bumpy rosette patterns on it. The scientific article that was published in Nature said, "The general skin pattern consists of round, non-overlapping, tubercle-like scales. A rosette pattern of scales is present in PVPH-130. Now, friends, we just learned that roughly 8 short years ago. How did those ancient Incas know what to draw if they'd never seen it? Or maybe somebody can explain to me the dinosaur figurines from Acambayo, Mexico. You know, if you were to go there today, there's a place called El Toro. It's a mountain called the Bull. And it was at the foothills of that particular mountain that a gentleman, he was riding on the back of a horse, and from that elevated position, he looked down, and he saw the first of these ceramic figurines. All told today, we found roughly 30,000 of them. And I think you would agree with me that several of them look like what you and I might call a dinosaur. Since they were ceramic, they'd been fired, they decided, hey, we'll send these things off to be tested, dated. But they didn't send complete dinosaur figurines, they just sent pieces. For instance, piece of a leg, piece of a tail. They sent it to 2 places here in the United States, Teledyne Laboratories and the University of Pennsylvania. Came back with dates of roughly 1860 BC, 2000 BC, 2400 BC. They said, whoa. They sent 8 additional samples off to be what's called thermoluminescent testing. They really wanted to make sure they had this thing right. And lo and behold, that came back with a date of roughly 2000 B.C. It was at that point that they called both laboratories and they said, hey, you know that material we're supplying you with? That came from dinosaur figurines. At which point, both laboratories did exactly the same thing. They withdrew their results and they said, oops, we're sorry, we're unable to give you accurate readings on your material. But in 1990, we caught them, so to speak. We sent some dinosaur bone off to the University of Arizona. We didn't tell them it was dinosaur bone. We just simply said, hey, can you date this material for us? They did. It came back with a date of roughly 9,000 years before present. Now, granted, that's not 6,000 years, but it's a far cry from the 225 million years that is in your child or grandchild's textbook. Or maybe somebody could explain to me the dinosaur petroglyph, the National Bridges National Monument. You know, if you were to go there to Blanding, Utah today, just outside of the city, you'll find not only this natural sandstone bridge, there's actually three of them. One of them is named Kachina. And it's on that particular bridge that you'll find this dinosaur petroglyph along with that of flying reptiles and other creatures. Friend Barnes made the comment, he said, there is a petroglyph in Natural Bridges National Monument that bears a striking resemblance to a dinosaur. What about those flying reptiles? Allegedly, they lived during the age of the dinosaurs. Died out 65 million years ago. Parents, grandparents, let me encourage you. Show your children two books. The first one was written by a man named Herodotus. He was a Greek historian from the 5th century B.C. Listen to what this historian talked about. He said, there is a place in Arabia to which I went on hearing of some winged serpents. When I arrived there, I saw bones and spines of serpents in such quantities as it would be impossible to describe. The form of the serpent is like that of a water snake, but he has wings without feathers and as like as possible to the wings of a bat. That's interesting. Here we have a Greek historian talking to us about these flying reptiles that allegedly existed before man ever came along. Or you can tell your child about a Jewish historian named Josephus. Who was Josephus? Oh, Josephus was the person who wrote not only about Jesus Christ, he also mentioned a man named Pilate who crucified Jesus. And he also talked about flying reptiles. He said, when the ground was difficult to be passed over because of the multitude of serpents, which it produced in vast numbers, some of which ascend out of the ground unseen and also fly in the air, and they do come upon men at unawares and do them a mischief. He said, Moses made baskets like unto arks of sage and filled them with ibs or birds. He carried them along with him, which animal is the greatest enemy to the serpents imaginable. For they fly from them when they come near them. And as they fly, they're caught and devoured by them. Okay, so let me get this straight. The person who was a historian for the Jews wrote about a man named Jesus Christ. He wrote about a man named Pilate. And yet he also wrote about flying reptiles. Or maybe somebody could explain to me the soft tissue that was found in a T-Rex bone last year. I actually communicated with the lady who made this discovery. Her name is Mary Schweitzer. She shared with me, she said, Brad, it was really a serendipitous event that we found it in the first place. They brought in the helicopter, but the T-Rex bone was too large. She said, we knew we were going to have to break it. So we purposefully broke the bone. And she said, it was only then that we were able to look inside and see exactly what we found. Soft tissue, blood vessels, and what we think are blood cells. Now, friends, I don't care. You can ask any molecular biologist worth their salt at all. They're going to tell you blood vessels, blood cells, they don't stick around for 65 million years. You see, we've got the evidence. Or we could talk about a gentleman named Samuel Hubbard, who took an expedition down into the Grand Canyon, off one of the side canyons, to the Havasupai Canyon. He took a group of people to look and see if he could prove that the American Indians had been on this continent much longer than we were giving them credit for. He was looking for things like their clothing or pieces of pottery, anything that would prove the American Indians were here before we knew about it. Lo and behold, Dr. Hubbard was right. He found their pottery, he found their clothing, but he also stumbled across their cave art. Etched into those canyon walls, there were beautiful pictures that had taken men literally hours to carve out. Pictures of what? Well, let's see. There were sheep, buffalo, dinosaurs, oxen, men. Run that list by me one more time. Sheep, buffalo, men, oxen, and dinosaurs. In fact, I want you to read with me what Dr. Hubbard had to say regarding his find. He said, "Taken all in all, the proportions are good. The huge reptile is depicted in the attitude in which man would most likely see it, reared on its hind legs, balancing with a long tail, either feeding or in a fighting position, possibly defending itself against a party of men." He said, "The fact that some prehistoric man made a pictograph of a dinosaur on the walls of this canyon upsets completely all of our theories regarding the antiquity of man. The fact that the animal is upright and balanced on its tail would seem to indicate that the prehistoric artist must have seen it alive." I brought with me a picture of what he found, and I hate to be the one to tell you, but that's not a cow. It's not a sheep. It's not an ox. But it's an awfully good representation of a creature that we now know existed called the Edmontosaurus. Friends, how did they know what to draw if they'd never seen that creature? Or maybe somebody could explain to me the tomb of Richard Bell. If you go over to England, let me encourage you, stop by the Carlisle Cathedral in England. Ask them to pull up that carpet that you see there at the bottom of the screen. Because below it is the tomb of a man who died in 1496. Now, hopefully you remembered when I told you the word dinosaur was coined. About 1845. This guy died in 1496 when this cathedral was being built. They put him in the ground. And you'll notice there's this nice, pretty little brass bronze ring that goes all the way around his tomb. And on that, they've carved different types of animals such as eels, foxes, cats, dogs, and dinosaurs. Also in that same cathedral, on the end of many of the pew seats, they actually have carved in creatures that you and I today would probably recognize as either a dragon or a dinosaur-like creature. Maybe somebody could explain to me the burial clothes and the pottery that were dated 700 AD in Peru that look a whole lot like what you and I might call a dinosaur. Or maybe somebody could explain to me the Roman mural from the 2nd century A.D. showing two long-necked dragons, realizing that mural was put into place by men who placed every single one of those tiles by hand. Or maybe somebody could explain to me the Mesopotamian cylinder seal, which looks a whole lot like what you and I might call today an Apatosaurus. Or maybe somebody could explain to me the tablets that are attributed to Denarmar, the legendary first pharaoh of a united Egypt, that also feature a creature that we would call a dinosaur. I hope you're getting the picture. You see, friends, there's lots and lots of evidence out there that exists that human beings coexisted with the dinosaurs. Will you see it in your child's science book? I doubt it, and here's why. If you're able to mix human beings with the dinosaurs, you have shaken literally the very foundation of the evolutionary theory. Somebody says, well, okay. Do we have other examples of animals that supposedly lived before men that really, as far as the evidence shows, didn't? Let's start with this guy right here. He's called a trilobite. You'll notice in this particular Holt science book, he's called an index fossil. They put him literally at the very bottom of the evolutionary time scale. 500 to 600 million years ago. On this, you'll notice fish come in right about here. Then we have dinosaurs, early mammals. Man would be very way up at the top of the screen. He is separated from man, according to evolutionists, by roughly 500 million evolutionary years. The only problem with that is in 1969, a fellow by the name of William Meister was out looking for trilobite fossils. He and seven of his friends who were acting as witnesses, they were climbing up a ledge in Antelope Springs, Utah. They tapped open some rocks. He found one, tapped it open. It split into two beautiful halves. And lo and behold, he found some trilobites embedded in the sandal print of a human being. Now, friends, think about that for just a moment. You have just collapsed this all the way up to here. You've effectively eliminated 500 million evolutionary years. Now, I've seen it. I actually had them take it out of a lockbox in Texas. Because I've been told that you could see the sandal stitching on that particular pair of sandals. There's no getting around it, folks. That's precisely what it is. And it's not just one trilobite, there are actually two. The guy who owned this particular pair of sandals, he was wearing the back heels down just like many of us men do on our shoes. The gentleman who owned this particular fossil, he told me, he said, I've been offered over $2 million by evolutionists who told me all they want to do is destroy it. While I was there, they showed me some other things. Here you can see a Mesoamerican piece of pottery. Don't know if you can tell or not, but the handle of that thing is carved into the shape of a dinosaur. Okay, what about this creature? Coelacanth. What I want you to notice about him is his front little lobe fin. Because according to many textbooks, this is the creature that allegedly walked out and gave rise to all land-dwelling creatures. So I guess we should probably pause for a moment and give thanks to this creature. What they did was they found some fossils, and you'll notice here you could just barely make out those little lobe fins. They saw these fossils and said, hey, this guy's got lobe front fins. Maybe he walked out and gave rise to all land-dwelling creatures. And so all of a sudden the textbooks became filled with images just like this one. They dated him at roughly 325 million years ago. Allegedly, this creature gave rise to the dinosaurs, which then gave rise to the mammals, which then gave rise to us. The only problem with that is they didn't live 325 million years ago. They're very much alive today. You see, the problem was we were looking for them in shallow water. They thought that they just walked out onto the beach. These are very, very deep water fish. They live below the 18-degree isotherm. People off the coast of India, Madagascar, they have been catching them literally for decades, calling them junk fish. And yet because we found some fossils that had this little front lobe fin and we couldn't figure it out, we decided that this was the link between the water and land-dwelling creatures. A link that was a lie. Okay, so it's pretty obvious then that the evolutionary timeline is not 100% accurate. So the question then becomes, okay, why aren't dinosaurs mentioned in the Bible? I mean, Brad, if you're going to stand up there and tell us that these creatures were 100 tons, that they lived and coexisted with man, then why in the world aren't they mentioned in here? It's not really a fair question, is it? Because you remember the date that I said the word dinosaur was coined? It's roughly 1845. When was your Bible translated into English? Well, if you've got a King James Version or one of those thereafter, the answer is 1611. How do you get a word in a book in 1611 when that word doesn't come along until 1845? A better question would be, is there compelling evidence of dinosaur-like creatures in this book? Now, that's a fair question. And to that I would say, if you have a Bible, turn with me to the book of Job. You guys remember the story of Job? The very first chapter we are introduced to a man who is smitten with all kinds of trials. You remember his family is taken away, his flocks are taken away. He is covered in boils from the bottom of his feet up to the crown of his head. He is in so much agony in chapter 2. His wife looks at him and says, why don't you just curse God and die? And yet he doesn't do that, does he? Because we know we're introduced very quickly after that statement to Job's three friends that come to comfort him. I put that in quotes on purpose because they're not what you and I would call friends. What they really are is busybodies. They're nosy. They assume that Job must have sinned big time to bring all this on his head. And so they want to know what he did. And so for the next 25 plus chapters, we have a running dialogue between Job and his three friends. Eliphaz comes up to him and says, "Come on, Job, you can tell us what you did." "I didn't do anything." And then Bildad will jump in and say, "Oh, you must have done something, Job. We can see by what's happening in your life, you must have committed a sin. What'd you do?" "I didn't do anything." And back and forth the conversation goes until at one point in a fit of anger, Job requests to speak to God. In fact, in chapter 13, verse 22, he says, "Then call and I will answer, or let me speak and you respond to me." He's saying, "I don't care, God, you can go first or I'll go first. It doesn't matter." Well, in Job chapter 38, we have God's response. "Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, 'Who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you, and you will answer me.'" God saying, "Stand up tall, young man. You and I are fixing to have a chat. You wanted to talk? Well, we're fixing to talk, except I'm going to be the one doing all the talking." And for the next three chapters, God deluges Job with question after question after question. And anytime you need a little lesson in humility, let me encourage you to go back and read Job chapter 38, 39, and 40. Because friends, many of those questions we still haven't answered today. "Hey, Job, where were you when I laid the foundations of the universe? Hey, Job, where's the dwelling place of light? Job, you see that hawk, that eagle? How do they fly? Job, what about snow and hail? How do I make those? Hey, Job, what about the behemoth?" The behemoth. Job chapter 40, starting in verse 15. "Look now at the behemoth which I made along with you. He eats grass like an ox. See now his strength is in his hips, the power is in his stomach muscles. He moves his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are tightly knit. His bones are like beams of bronze. His ribs are like bars of iron. He is chief in the ways of God." What in the world is a behemoth? And somebody says, "Well, Brad, I'm glad you're here this weekend, because my Bible tells you exactly what a behemoth is. I got a little footnote here in my Bible that says it's either an elephant or a hippopotamus." Well, let me first remind you, those footnotes are not inspired, are they? But I'll go along with you for just a moment. Look at the description of this creature. It says, "Lo, now his strength was in his loins, the force is in the navel of his belly." Obviously, this was a creature with a large stomach. That guy have a big belly? Yeah. That guy have a big belly? Yep. He have a big belly? Yep. Keep reading. Job chapter 40, verse 17. "He moves his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his stones are wrapped together." Now, friends, when it's talking about a cedar here, we're talking about some of the biggest trees ever used to build the temple. You remember the cedars of Lebanon? In fact, if you look back through the Old Testament, how that word was used, you'll recognize these were some of the mightiest of trees. Question: that looked like a cedar to you? Not exactly. How about that? Not exactly. That's getting a whole lot closer, isn't it? It describes this thing as chief in the ways of God. What is the largest land-dwelling creature that we've ever known that's walked this earth? It's the dinosaurs. In fact, if you go one chapter later, Job chapter 41, it says, "Can you draw out Leviathan with a hook?" Suddenly we're talking about another creature. Listen to the descriptions. I'll read various passages starting in verse 2. "Can you put a reed through his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Though the sword reaches him, it cannot avail, nor does the spear, the dart, or javelin. Darts are regarded as straw and bronze as rotten wood. His undersides are like sharp pieces of pottery. He spreads pointed marks in the mire. On earth there is nothing like him which is made without fear. He beholds every high thing." What's a Leviathan? Then somebody says, well, my Bible describes this as a crocodile or an alligator. Okay, first off, how many crocodiles or alligators do you know of that behold every high thing? And what's one of the softest places on an alligator or crocodile? It's that soft underbelly, isn't it? And yet it says, his undersides are like sharp pieces of pottery. Verse 31 of that particular chapter says, he makes the deep to boil like a pot. Now think about it for just a moment. If a crocodile or alligator is after you, is he going to stir up the water like a boiling pot? Or is he going to be a very stealthy creature and basically just kind of sink down? And about the time you realize you shouldn't have been swimming there, it's too late, isn't it? What was this creature? Well, I think the next few verses will probably reveal that pretty well. Job chapter 41, verses 18 and following. His sneezings flash forth light, and his eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. Out of his mouth go burning lights, sparks of fire shoot out. Smoke goes out of his nostrils as from a boiling pot and burning rushes. His breath kindles coals, and a flame of fire goes out of his mouth. Can an 8-year-old child tell me what I just described? Does the word dragon come to mind? Do we have historical accounts of dragons on almost every single continent from various cultures? Oh, yeah. Marco Polo lived in China 17 years, approximately AD 1271, reported that Chinese emperor raised dragons to pull his chariots in parades. 1611, the emperor initiated the post of royal dragon feeder. Chinese families are said to have raised dragons in order to use their blood for medicines, highly prizing their eggs. The Vikings, they knew about dragons, or at least they carved their likeness onto their ships. Somebody says, wait a second, he's going to stand up there and tell us these things are real? Surely this is like poetic language or figurative language in the Bible. Friends, let me remind you what's happening in the context right here. God is questioning Job. He's saying, how did I make this? How did I do this? Why is he then going to turn to two imaginary or poetic creatures and say, oh, Job, what about these two creatures? If you had never in your life heard of an electric eel, didn't know they existed, I walk up to you and I say, hey, my name is Brad Harab. I want to talk to you about a little creature. He lives in the water. He's roughly 3 feet long. He can deliver 500 volts on demand. Doesn't shock himself. He doesn't shock his mate when he reproduces. And he can recharge himself without an extension cord. You'd think I was crazy. And yet, friends, we know that this world is full of God's amazing creations. Right now, one of the hottest things in science is something that I suspect every single person in here, maybe one or two exceptions, has probably at some point or another grabbed a mason jar. If you were nice, you jabbed holes in the top of it. You went out back on a summer night and you collected fireflies or lightning bugs. Do you realize that lightning bugs, when they produce light, they don't give off any heat from it? It's cool light. All of the light that man has ever been able to create, we lose a lot of our energy from heat. And as such, you know what scientists are busy studying, trying to replicate? The cool light from a firefly. Of course, they're also real quick to tell us that that was not intelligently designed. Kind of feel sorry for them if it was, I guess. What about this creature? Bombardier beetle. This guy has two separate isolated chambers in his backside. And anytime he feels threatened, let's say a frog comes hopping along and says, I think I'll have me a beetle tonight. He dumps the contents of those two chambers into a central boiling chamber in his backside. He adds enzymes, instantly heating that mixture up to the boiling point, which he is then able to shoot out of a turret out of his backside 280 degrees, anywhere he wants to spray it. Right in the face of that frog. Then all of a sudden that frog says, I don't think so. Now can somebody please share with me how through a series of evolutionary transitions you can create something like that? Can you imagine? You've got 97% of those two chambers isolated. And just a little bit trickles out, you got to start all over. Friends, that is not the product of evolution. That is the handiwork of Almighty God. Somebody says, well, Brad, you've got a problem. Because Job is a post-flood book. Meaning, we know that, by the way, Job and his three friends were worshiping, it fits in after the flood. Now, we think it's one of the first ones that was actually written. But chronologically, we feel very certain it fits in after the flood. Now, you're going to stand up there and tell us that dinosaurs were created with man on day six. Yeah, that's what the Bible teaches. And then you're going to tell us that they were around after the flood? Wouldn't that mean... Yep, they had to be on the ark. And before you buy one of those special white coats that ties in the back for me, give me just a moment to explain. You know, there's lots of things that you and I are not privileged to when it comes to the Bible, and I think this is one of those occasions. Ask yourself the question, did Noah have to take adult-sized animals on board that ark? Nope. Could he have taken juveniles? Well, let's see. They take up less space, they eat less food, they don't produce as much waste. You don't have to worry about reproductive issues. I mean, you think about Mr. and Mrs. Adult Rabbit on that boat for a year. Have you ever seen what a dinosaur comes from? Fits very comfortably in the palm of my hand. In fact, the largest dinosaur egg that we've ever discovered would fit very comfortably in both of my hands. So is it possible that God allowed Noah to take juvenile animals? Yeah. Well, then as I see it, we've only got one question left. What happened to him? Now, friends, I wish that I could finish this particular lesson by simply saying, all the dinosaurs died out because we take our stretch break and we go about our merry business. But in all honesty, we don't know. We've got theories. Right now, I'm aware of 24 theories of why the dinosaurs died out. They actually came out with another one about 2 or 3 months ago. Moms, you'll love this one. The latest theory, according... Now, this is really sad, but it's a scientific theory. The latest theory, according to scientists, of why the dinosaurs died out was because of lack of sleep. I imagine John Brown and his family may be going extinct very soon with a newborn. I brought with me 5 other theories of why supposedly they died. Anywhere from the number one would be an asteroid struck the earth causing worldwide fires. Number two, a nearby exploding star flooded the earth with intense radiation. Number three, the earth's climate became too warm, too cold, too dry, too wet. Number four, a change in the dinosaur's diet resulted in weakened eggshells that broke after being laid. And sad to say, number five is actually a scientific theory. A laxative plan in the dinosaur's diet disappeared and they all died of constipation. Do I have a theory that I think works? Yeah, I think so. I want you to think back with me to about 8 years ago. Of course, if it keeps raining tonight, you won't have to think very long, but... About 8 years ago, the Mississippi River overflooded its banks. You remember watching some of those 24-hour news shows? They would show all the little bitty towns up and down the river, and you'd look, and there'd be a house there, and then it'd be gone. At the time, my wife and I, we lived in Memphis, Tennessee, and I can still remember they would send a newscast reporter down every single night, show us where the flood stage, what level it was at. For that matter, you could just think to last year, Hurricane Katrina. Remember? Hurricane comes through. They think they dodged the bullet. They're out in the street that night. They're dancing. They're partying. They go back to their homes. They go to bed. And then the levees break. And I want you to think with me for just a moment about what it sounded like in the city of New Orleans. 3 o'clock in the morning. People's homes began literally just to fill up with water. Many of them realized they were trapped. They couldn't get out. They would try to work their way up into the attics. They couldn't get out of their attics, and lo and behold, screams all through the night. Now imagine what it would be like to have been there at a worldwide global flood. And you can imagine the screams. But now that that water has gone back, we look at New Orleans, we look at the mess that was left. Or we look at that Mississippi River that had overflowed its banks. All the water finally went back in the banks. Remember what it looked like? There was just muck and dirt and devastation for miles. And yet, friends, that was just one river on one continent. I want you to think with me for just a moment about how much devastation there would be from a global flood from an angry God. I do think those dinosaurs walked on that ark. And I think when they walked on the ark, there was still that mantle of spring-like loveliness in place.